Imagine sliding a silver briefcase containing $10 million in cash across the table to a complete stranger.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, right? You let go of the handle, they pull it toward them, and now you're just sitting there sweating, hoping that, you know, in a few minutes, they're going to slide a second briefcase full of stock certificates back to you.
Sounds incredibly stressful.
Right. Because if they don't, you're bankrupt. It sounds like a tense scene from a heist movie, but until the modern clearing system was invented, that was essentially how Wall Street operated every single day.
Pretty much, yeah.
So welcome to the Deep Dive. Before we get into the weeds, a quick shout out. This Deep Dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. Look, studying for the Series 99 can feel like, I don't know, trying to memorize a phone book written in a different language.
It's dense, very dense.
Exactly. And Cert Fuel makes it actually manageable. They've got a full Series 99 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. It basically figures out what you don't know and forces you to learn it. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Highly recommend.
So usually when we talk about buying or selling something in the real world, there is this expectation of precision and immediacy. Like you hand over cash at the coffee shop, they hand you a latte.
Right.
It is binary. It is clean, done or not done.
Exactly. It's an instant, visible, physical exchange. And, you know, our brains like things to be categorized simply like that. But when you step into the world of broker-dealers, clearing agencies, and institutional finance, you are leaving that clean coffee shop transaction far behind.
We're looking at a landscape where millions of shares and billions of dollars are moving, like every second. The sheer volume is terrifying.
It really is. And the potential for things to break down is enormous. Because when a trade is executed on an exchange, it isn't just magically, you know, done. There is a massive, complex, heavily regulated plumbing system working beneath the surface to ensure the money and the shares actually end up where they are supposed to be.
And that plumbing system is our mission today. If you are prepping for your Series 99, consider this your ultimate survival guide to settlement questions.
Absolutely.
We are going to master how trades actually get finalized, what the mechanical steps are, and most importantly, what happens when the pipes burst and the whole system breaks down.
Because here is where amateur brokers completely blow up their firms. The exam doesn't just want to know if you can define a term. They want to test you on the breakdowns.
The messy stuff.
Yeah. The exceptions, the fails, the moments where the plumbing gets clogged. That is where they separate the people who just, you know, memorize flashcards from the people who actually understand the mechanics of the market.
So to help us navigate this, I want to introduce you to two recurring characters we are going to use today. If you have ADHD like me, abstract rules just evaporate from your brain the second you hear them. So we need to attach these rules to real people. First, we have Sloppy Sam.
Oh, Sloppy Sam.
Sam is a broker-dealer. He means well, but his desk is a disaster zone. He uses sticky notes that have lost their stick.
Yeah.
He enters the wrong prices, forgets to send shares, and routinely spills iced coffee on his keyboard. He is basically a walking compliance violation.
I have absolutely audited firms with a Sloppy Sam.
I bet you have.
They are the reason these regulations exist in the first place, to be honest.
Exactly. And on the other side of the trade, we have cautious Chloe. Chloe is an institutional customer. She manages a $1 billion pension fund for the Tri-State Teachers Union.
Heavy responsibility.
Huge. And she is absolutely terrified of losing her retirees' cash because of someone else's mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So she trusts no one. She demands everything by the book, and she probably, like, audits her own grocery receipts.
Which is a very healthy mindset for an institutional fiduciary, actually.
Right. So we have Sam creating chaos and Chloe demanding perfection. Let's see how the system handles them. So before a single dollar or share can ever change hands, we have a massive hurdle to clear. We have to make sure Sloppy Sam and the broker on the other side of the trade actually agree on what just happened in the market.
And this is a fundamental distinction you need to make right out of the gate for the exam. You must separate trade comparison from settlement.
Okay.
They are completely different phases of the life cycle. Comparison is simply establishing the transaction details. It is the agreement phase.
Mm-hmm.
Settlement, on the other hand, is the actual delivery of the securities and the payment.
Okay, so comparison is the handshake. Settlement is handing over the keys to the car.
Precisely. For a trade comparison to be valid, an inter-firm comparison or confirmation has to give the buyer and seller enough information to mutually agree on the reality of the trade.
Makes sense.
That means it must include an adequate description of the security, the exact price, the quantity, and any other information needed for both parties to essentially say, yes, we are living in the same reality.
But knowing Sloppy Sam, he probably typed in that he sold 1,000 shares of Apple at $150, but the broker on the other side thinks they bought 100 shares of Apple at $150. What happens then?
The system halts, and this is where the exam tries to get you, so pay attention.
Okay, lay it on us.
They will present a scenario where both parties submit trade reports to a clearing facility, but the details are slightly off, like your example, a mismatched quantity, or maybe a typo in the price.
Right.
The trick is making you think that because they both reported a trade, the system will just, you know, meet them in the middle or accept it as a matched comparison.
Oh, like close enough, let's just push it through.
Right, but it absolutely does not.
So different reported details never establish a matched comparison. It's an all or nothing match.
All or nothing. A trade comparison must carry everything needed for total agreement.
Okay, but what if Sam just ignores the mismatch and forces the paperwork through a settlement arrangement anyway? Like, he just pushes the buttons on his terminal and hopes nobody notices. Does that mean the trade is officially complete because it's, like, in the system?
I'm glad you asked, because that's another really common exam trap.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Processing a trade through a settlement arrangement does not prove it is complete. Just because it's sitting in the clearing facility's digital inbox doesn't mean it's resolved. Open, mismatched positions can remain open and recycle through the system.
Recycle?
Yeah, they just carry forward day after day until someone actually fixes the mismatch.
Wow, okay. So step one is absolute agreement. But what happens if Sam is absolutely convinced he sold 1,000 shares of Tesla to another broker, he sends over the trade details, and the other broker, the contra member, looks at it and says, I have absolutely no record of this.
Now we are entering the territory of the don't know or DK trade.
Wait, I like to think of a DK trade kind of like Venmo.
Okay, how so?
If we go out to dinner and I send you a Venmo request for $50 for quote unquote pizza and you just ignore it, does that mean you legally owe me $50?
Well, in the real world, no. Ignoring a Venmo request just means you're a bad friend, but it doesn't establish a debt.
Right.
But in the broker-dealer world, the rules for silence are heavily codified.
Explain that, because if Sam claims the trade happened, and he sends a formal notice to the contra member asking them to confirm or DK it, what is that contra member actually required to do?
They can't just delete the message. Receiving that notice triggers a strict regulatory duty for them to actively research the trade.
Oh, so they have to do homework.
Exactly. They have to dig into their own ledgers. If they research it and find absolutely no record of the trade Sam is claiming, they must send back a signed DK notice that explicitly communicates, you know, we do not recognize this trade. It did not happen on our end.
But what if the contra member is just as sloppy as Sam? Like, what if they go on a golf trip, they completely miss the email, and they just ghost him entirely? No response whatsoever.
This is a really critical rule. Under the alternative form of the procedure, for a member-to-member trade outside a registered clearing organization's normal automated process, a lack of response actually constitutes a DK. Silence is a rejection.
Hold on, I want to push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
Because that seems incredibly dangerous. You're telling me if a broker just goes on vacation or their Wi-Fi drops, the system automatically voids a potentially multi-million dollar trade.
Mm-hmm.
Why on earth would they design it like that?
Well, think about the alternative. The market moves way too fast. Prices fluctuate by the second. If silence meant yes, or if silence meant, you know, we just wait indefinitely, you would have massive counterparty risk hanging in the air for weeks.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a broker could claim you bought a stock that is currently crashing, and while you're on vacation, you're supposedly absorbing all those losses. To protect the system, the rule demands affirmative agreement. If you ignore the request to confirm, the system has to assume you don't know the trade, otherwise the risk is just too high.
That is wild. But it makes total logical sense when you explain the risk side of it. So silence is a rejection. If I Venmo request you for pizza and you ignore it, the broker-dealer system says, cool, no pizza debt exists.
Precisely. No pizza debt. Now, you need to be very careful here.
Yeah.
Because the Series 99 loves to muddy the waters by mixing up a DK trade with an aged delivery fail.
I mean, I can see how those sound similar to someone just reading them. The trade failed versus I don't know the trade. Let's do a side-by-side comparison so I don't fail this on the test. What is the fundamental difference?
It all comes down to what the parties actually agreed on in reality. A DK issue occurs at the comparison stage. We don't even agree the trade occurred. Sloppy Sam says it happened. The contra member says it didn't. There is no contract.
So DK equals disagreement on reality.
Right. Disagreement on reality. An aged delivery fail is fundamentally different. In a delivery fail, the comparison phase was 100% successful. Sloppy Sam and the Contra member both shook hands and agreed, yes, Sam sold 1,000 shares of Tesla. The contract is locked in. The problem is, settlement day arrives, and Sam spills coffee on his keyboard and never actually delivers the shares.
Oh. So a delivery fail is a broken promise in reality. We agreed to the rules. Sam just broke
them. Which means you cannot apply DK procedures to an aged delivery fail.
Oh, because it's too late for that.
Exactly. If Sam fails to deliver, the Contra member can't suddenly say, oh, well, I guess the trade didn't happen. I'm DKing it. No. The trade is confirmed. An aged securities fail requires a completely separate confirmation and resolution process. You can't retroactively don't know a trade you already agreed to just because the other guy is late.
Okay, repetition time to lock this in for everyone listening. DK means we do not agree the trade even happened. Silence to a DK notice equals a DK. An aged delivery fail means we agreed on the trade, but Sloppy Sam forgot to send the shares. Two entirely different phases of the life cycle.
Spot on. Perfect summary.
So let's assume Sloppy Sam and the other broker actually get their act together for once. They compare the trade, they agree on the details, the handshake is done. Now we have to actually swap the assets. How do we ensure Sam doesn't just take the cash and run before handing over the shares?
Well, we use a system designed to mitigate credit risk.
I call this the hostage exchange.
A hostage exchange.
Yeah, imagine an action movie. You're in a dimly lit, deserted warehouse. You have a briefcase full of cash. The villain has a briefcase full of bearer bonds.
Yeah.
If you just hand over your cash and politely wait for him to hand over the bonds, he might just shoot you and take both, right?
Unlikely on Wall Street, but sure.
Well, financially shoot you. So what do? You slide the briefcases across the concrete floor at the exact same time. You do not take your hand off the cash until your other hand is firmly gripping the handle of the bonds.
As dramatic as that is, it is the perfect mechanical visualization of DVP, or delivery versus payment.
Okay, let's talk about cautious Chloe. She manages this massive pension fund. She is buying a block of stock for $50 million from Sloppy Sam's firm. Why does she absolutely insist on using DVP?
Because she is terrified of one-sided settlement. She refuses to take on Sam's credit risk during the exchange. If Chloe sends $50 million to Sam's firm on Tuesday morning, and Sam's firm unexpectedly declares bankruptcy on Tuesday afternoon before sending her the stock,
Chloe's pensioners just lost $50 million.
Exactly. She becomes an unsecured creditor in a bankruptcy court, which is a nightmare.
A total nightmare. So DVP links the instructions. The delivery of securities is legally and mechanically conditional upon the payment. The buyer's agent receives the shares only in exchange for the seller's agent receiving the cash.
Exactly. It prevents the gap where things can go wrong. Now, I have a question for you.
Hit me.
If DVP, delivery versus payment, describes the transaction from the perspective of the delivering or selling side, what do we call the exact same transaction from the receiving or buying side?
Okay, listener, pause and think about this for a second. If the seller is delivery versus payment, what is the buyer? Give you a beat.
It's RVP, receive versus payment.
It's literally the exact same warehouse hostage exchange. We're just looking at it from the other guy's camera angle.
Exactly. DVP and RVP identify opposite sides of the exact same linked exchange. It just depends on whether you are the one sliding the cash or sliding the shares.
I know there is an exam trap here regarding credit risk versus customer protection. This feels like an area where the test writers really try to confuse two good things.
Yes, this is where the exam tries to get you. They will ask you what the purpose of DVP is, and they will put customer asset protection as one of the multiple choice answers.
And it sounds so right.
It does, but do not pick it. You need to keep them entirely separate in your mind. DVP is designed specifically to prevent credit risk during the settlement exchange itself. It's about the safety of the transaction while it is in transit.
What is customer asset protection then? Let's clarify that.
Customer asset protection rules govern the possession and control of property the broker-dealer already carries for the customer in their accounts. It's about how safe the assets are while they are just sitting motionless in the vault, not while they are crossing the table.
Got it. Okay, so DVP is armor for the highway. Asset protection is a vault for the house. Different risks, different rules. Now, if cautious Chloe is doing these massive DVP transactions, is she demanding physical paper stock certificates? Like, is she sending armored trucks full of paper to a warehouse?
Absolutely not. If cautious Chloe does a customer DVP or RVP transaction in a depository-eligible security, the rules mandate how it must settle. It must settle by book entry through a securities depository.
Okay, let's demystify that jargon really quickly. What does depository-eligible and book entry actually mean in plain English?
Well, decades ago, Wall Street literally used messengers running through the streets of Manhattan with bags full of paper stock certificates.
Sounds exhausting.
And dangerous. It was prone to theft, and during high-volume trading days, the paperwork backed up so badly that the stock market actually had to close on Wednesdays just to let the clerks catch up.
Wait, they just closed the market on Wednesday?
Yeah, it was called the paper crunch of 1968.
That's insane. So they obviously needed a better way.
Right. So they created centralized depositories like the Depository Trust Company, or DTC. The DTC holds the physical certificates in a giant, highly secure vault. When a security is depository eligible, it means it's tracked by this system.
Okay.
Book entry means that when Chloe buys shares from Sam, no paper moves at all. The depository simply updates a digital ledger, a book saying, subtract 1,000 shares from Sam's account, add 1,000 shares to Chloe's account.
So the paper never leaves the central vault.
Yeah.
It's just a digital scoreboard updating the score.
Exactly. It eliminates the physical risk of fire, theft, or forgery. The book entry duty applies based on both the customer type and the security type.
Okay, so that's the DDP hostage exchange. Now, while we're talking about these specific types of conditional transactions, we have to talk about repos. Repurchase agreements.
Repos are fascinating because they look like two separate trades, but mechanically and legally, they are one cohesive arrangement.
Let's say Sloppy Sam needs cash today to cover a margin call, but all he has are treasury bonds. How does he use a repo?
A repo combines a security sale with a baked-in, legally binding agreement to buy those exact same securities back at a later date, usually at a slightly higher price.
Okay, wait. So he's selling them, but he has to buy them back. That just sounds like a short-term loan where he's using the bonds as collateral, like he's going to a pawn shop.
Your pawn shop analogy is actually very close to the economic reality, but legally it is structured as a sale and repurchase. Sam sells the bonds to Chloe today for cash. They sign a contract saying Sam will buy them back next Thursday for a little bit more cash, and that difference is basically the interest rate.
Ah, okay. And similar to the DVP and RVP mirror effect we just talked about, repos have a mirrored perspective too, right?
Yes. From Sam's side, the person initiating it, who needs the cash, he is selling and agreeing to repurchase. But from Chloe's view, the person handing over the cash today, it is viewed as a resale agreement.
Right, because she's buying them now to sell them back.
Exactly. She is buying the bonds today, knowing she is contractually obligated to resell them back to Sam next Thursday.
Same exact arrangement, just viewed from opposite sides of the table. Now, here's where the rules get tight on the exam. What if Sam's firm enters into a repo with Chloe, but Sam's firm decides they're going to retain custody of those treasury bonds during the life of the agreement? Like, they aren't actually sending the bonds over to Chloe's digital vault. They're just keeping them in Sam's account.
Yeah.
Oh, cautious Chloe's going to hate that. She just handed over millions in cash, and Sam still has the collateral. Why would she ever agree to that?
Because transferring securities back and forth for a 3-day repo is expensive and administratively heavy. It's often much cheaper to just let the broker-dealer hold them. But to protect Chloe from Sam just, you know, selling those bonds to someone else while he's holding them, the SEC imposes strict rules.
Okay.
If a broker-dealer retains custody of repo securities, they need 4 specific safeguards, and this is heavily tested.
Let's break them down logically. What's the first one?
1, they must obtain the repurchase agreement in writing.
Makes sense. You need the overarching master contract. Number 2.
2, they must provide timely written confirmations.
So the agreement is the master contract. The confirmation is the receipt for that specific daily transaction.
Got it.
What's number 3?
3. They must provide a protection notice. This formally tells Chloe, hey, these bonds belong to you. They're separated from the general assets of our firm. If we go bankrupt, our creditors can't touch these.
Crucial for her peace of mind, obviously. And the final rule.
4. The broker-dealer must actually maintain possession or control of the securities subject to the agreement. They can't lend them out to short sellers to make a quick buck. They have to sit in a segregated box, metaphorically speaking.
So to recap, written agreement, confirmation receipt, protection notice, and actual segregated possession. If you understand why Chloe is scared of Sam going bankrupt, those 4 rules are just common sense protections?
Exactly. They just follow the logic of risk.
All right, pattern interrupt.
Oh, here we go.
if you are doing the dishes, walking the dog, or zoning out on your phone right now, stop and come back to me. We are about to cover continuous net settlement, or CNS. It is arguably the most important plumbing mechanism in the entire equity market. It is heavily tested, and it genuinely breaks people's brains if they don't grasp the core concept. Lock in right now.
Yes, the system we just described, DVP, hostage exchanges, one-on-one repo deals, that is great for cautious Chloe doing one massive block trade. But what happens on a normal Tuesday when the market is open and millions of retail and institutional trades are happening every second?
The system would completely collapse if every single trade required a simultaneous, isolated exchange of cash and securities between the original two broker-dealers. Like, if Sam is selling Apple to broker A, buying Microsoft from broker B, selling Tesla to broker C, it would be total chaos.
The friction would ruin the business, which is why the clearing agencies created continuous net settlement.
Okay, I want to try an analogy here. I compare CNS to a massive, incredibly busy bar tab.
Okay, I'm listening.
Imagine a bar with 1,000 people in it. If you order a beer and the bartender makes you swipe your credit card for that one $6 beer, and then 10 minutes later you order some fries and have to swipe your card again, and then you buy a friend a drink and swipe again, the bartender would spend all night just waiting on credit card machines.
Correct. The transaction costs and time delays would be astronomical.
So instead, the bartender takes your card at the beginning of the night and opens a tab. You buy 10 things, maybe you win a bet, and the bartender owes you a free drink, whatever. At the very end of the night, they total everything you bought, subtract anything owed to you, and you run your card for one net number.
This is a great starting point, but CNS goes one step further.
Okay.
It introduces a miracle called novation.
Novation.
Yes. In your bar tab analogy, if you buy a drink from another patron, you owe that patron. But in CNS, the bartender, the clearing agency, literally steps in the middle. The clearing agency buys the drink from the patron and resells it to you.
Whoa. So the clearing agency becomes the ultimate counterparty for everyone.
Yes. When a trade enters CNS, the original members no longer face each other for delivery and payment. The clearing agency becomes the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer.
That is wild.
It localizes the risk. If Sloppy Sam goes bankrupt at 2 p.m., Broker B doesn't have to panic, because Broker B isn't waiting for shares from Sam anymore. Broker B is waiting for shares from the clearing agency. The clearing agency guarantees the trade.
That is mind-blowing. So how does the daily math actually work for Sloppy Sam's bar tab in real life?
It's a three-step process. First, the system enters the member settling purchases and sales for a specific security, say, all of Sam's activity in Apple stock today. Second, it combines that daily activity with any open position carried over from yesterday. If Sam owed 500 shares of Apple from yesterday, that negative balance rolls right into today's math.
So the tab carries over.
Right. And third, it nets all those amounts to determine one final result for that member for that specific security. Millions of trades become one net number.
Let's define the three possible outcomes of that math. What does it mean if Sloppy Sam is net long in Apple stock at the end of the day in CNS?
Net long means the clearing agency owes the security to Sam. He bought more Apple stock than he sold, so the system owes him shares. If they don't arrive, this is known as a fail to receive on Sam's end.
What if he is net short?
Net short means Sam owes the security to the clearing agency. He sold more than he bought. He has to deliver those shares into the system. If he doesn't, it's a fail to deliver.
And flat.
Flat means the obligation's fully offset. He bought 1,000 shares. He sold 1,000 shares. The net is zero. He owes nothing. He receives nothing.
Okay, here is a direct question for you, listener. Think about this. So if Sam has a net short position, meaning he owes 500 shares of Tesla to the clearing agency, and the end of the day arrives, and Sam just doesn't have them, he fails to deliver. What happens to that fail in the CNS system overnight? Does it get canceled? Does he get heavily fined instantly? Does the trade reverse?
Take a beat. What happens to an open fail in CNS?
Mm.
It stays an open net position and carries forward to net with tomorrow's trades.
This rolls over.
Yes. Inside CNS, an uncompleted delivery remains a fail position and simply carries into the next day's netting. The tab stays open. Tomorrow morning, Sam starts the day at negative 500 shares. If he sells another 100 tomorrow without delivering any, now he's at negative 600. It snowballs. CNS does not preserve a separate delivery obligation for every single failed trade. It just tracks the one rolling net debt.
But wait, they can't just let him roll his debt over forever.
Yeah.
Right? The clearing agency or the person who got the shares is eventually going to say, you know, enough is enough. We need our stock.
Which brings us perfectly to the final phase of the life cycle. What happens when the system loses patience and forces his hand?
Right. When things break. Buy-ins and regulations, SHO closeouts. So Sloppy Sam owes shares, he keeps failing to deliver them, the negative balance keeps rolling over in CNS. How do we force him to pay up? Let's start with buy-ins. What is the mechanism of a buy-in?
A buy-in is a nuclear option for the buyer to close a seller's uncompleted contract.
You nuclear option.
Yes. Cautious Chloe essentially says, look, Sam, you promised me these shares. You haven't delivered them. I am done waiting. I am going to go out into the open market right now. I'm going to buy them from a totally different broker to satisfy my need. And you are going to foot the bill for whatever it costs me.
Oh, wow. So if Chloe buys the stock at today's market price and the price went up $20 a share since Sam originally sold it to her, Sam has to pay that difference out of his own pocket.
Precisely. The purchase is for the account and liability of the party in default. Sam pays the penalty for failing.
Now, Chloe can't just do this immediately, right? She can't buy him in 5 minutes after the deadline. There have to be rules around this.
There are strict timelines, and the exam will absolutely test you on them. For a standard contract, the buyer may close the seller's uncompleted contract no sooner than the third business day following the date delivery was due.
Okay, let's map that out so I can picture it.
Yeah.
If delivery was due on Monday, Tuesday is day one, Wednesday is day two, so Thursday is the third business day, I can't execute the buy-in until Thursday at the earliest.
Correct. But let me clarify a massive exam trap here. That third business day is the earliest permitted execution date. It is not a mandatory deadline. Coffice Chloe may execute on Thursday. She doesn't have to. She could wait until Friday if she wants.
Okay, so it opens the window. It doesn't close it. Now, can Chloe just surprise Sam on Thursday morning and say, surprise, I bought the shares. Wire me the cash.
No, no. Before the proposed buy-in, the buyer must deliver written notice to the seller. You have to give them a formal heads up that the guillotine is dropping.
Okay, so standard timeline. No sooner than the third business day after the due date, and it requires prior written notice. But what if it's not a standard contract? What if it's a cash contract or a guaranteed delivery contract?
This is a special timing path. Cash contracts are meant to settle same day or next day. There is no time for a 3-day grace period. So if it is a contract made for cash or guaranteed delivery, it may be bought in without prior notice during normal trading hours on the day after delivery was due.
Whoa! Next day and no prior warning.
Exactly. The buyer still has to send a notice to Sam, but they send it after the execution has already happened.
That is a huge difference. Standard is wait 3 days, send notice first. Cash or guarantees is wait 1 day, execute immediately, then send notice. This is where the exam tries to get you. You have to know which contract you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
Now, let's put Sloppy Sam in the hot seat. He receives a written notice from Chloe that a standard buy-in is going to happen on Thursday. He's panicking. Is there any way he can defend himself? Like, can he throw a flag on the play to pause the clock?
There are two main defenses that control the execution. First, Sam can demand proof.
Proof of what?
Proof of the obligation. If he replies and says, wait, show me the paperwork that proves I owe this specific fail obligation, Chloe cannot execute the buy-in until she delivers that proof. Demanding receipts pauses the clock.
Makes sense. What's the second defense?
Physical possession. If Sam gives timely notice that the actual physical stock certificates are in his possession and he is promptly delivering them, the buyer cannot execute the buy-in for those specific securities.
So if Sam is digging through his office and finds the physical stock certificate stuck behind a filing cabinet, and he runs into the lobby waving them around saying, I have them, they're right here, Chloe has to stand down.
Exactly. Proof of obligation and physical possession are his shields.
Now, a buy-in is a tool the buyer can use. Chloe uses it to make herself whole. It's optional for her. But there is another set of rules governing fails that isn't optional. It's a regulatory mandate from the SEC. Let's talk about Regulation SHO closeouts.
Reg SHO was implemented to curb naked short selling, where people sell shares they don't have and never intend to deliver. Reg SHO imposes a mandatory strict obligation on the clearing agency participant. The SEC doesn't care if the buyer is being patient. If you have an equity security failed to deliver at the clearing agency, Reg SHO dictates exactly when and how you must close it out.
And the timeline depends entirely on the source of the failure. Let's look at the two main categories they test. First, documented long sale fails and bona fide market making fails.
For documented long sales and bona fide market making, you have a little bit of breathing room. The deadline to close out the fail is the third consecutive settlement day following the settlement date.
Okay, third day. And if Sam hits that deadline, How is he legally allowed to fix the fail?
Mm-hmm.
Does he have to buy the shares in the open market?
For those specific categories, he has an option. He can either purchase or borrow securities of like kind and quantity to satisfy the closeout.
Oh, so he could just borrow the shares from another institution to plug the hole and deliver them to CNS. That's relatively lenient. But there is a second category that is much stricter, right?
Yes. The deemed owned delivery restriction fail.
Say that five times fast. What on earth is a deemed owned delivery restriction?
Think about a CEO who owns millions of shares of their own company, but those shares are locked up in a legal trust that doesn't expire for another 20 days. The CEO legitimately owns them and sells them today, knowing they will be legally restricted from moving them until the trust unlocks. That is a deemed owned delivery restriction. There is a legitimate mechanical reason for the delay, and the seller intends to deliver as soon as the restriction ends.
Because there is a legitimate legal reason for the delay, RegSHO gives them a much longer leash.
Exactly. A fail from a sale of a deemed owned restricted security is due on the 35th consecutive calendar day following the trade date.
35 calendar days. That's a massive window. But wait.
I know what you're going to ask.
Direct question to the listener. We know Sloppy Sam has 35 days to fix this deemed owned restriction fail. When day 35 rolls around and the shares still haven't arrived, can he just borrow the shares to fix it like he could with a market maker fails?
Take a second. Can he borrow to fix a 35-day restricted fail?
Think about it.
Answer is no. This is where the exam tries to get you. It is a massive trap.
So no borrowing allowed.
The deemed owned delivery restriction fail requires a purchase. You cannot borrow to satisfy this specific closeout. You must execute a purchase of like kind and quantity in the open market.
Why? Why is the SEC so strict about purchase only here?
Because if you just borrow shares after waiting 35 days, you aren't actually solving the systemic problem. You are just creating a new obligation to return borrowed shares to someone else. You're kicking the can down the road. The SEC says after 35 days, enough is enough. Go into the open market, buy real shares, and permanently close the loop.
Wow. Okay, so third day fails allow purchase or borrow. 35th day restricted fails require a purchase only. That distinction just screams test question to me.
It does. Always check the category of the fail before applying a timeline and the required method.
Okay, my brain is officially full. We have covered the entire life cycle, from the handshake to the hostage exchange to the bar tab to the nuclear options. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute highest yield testable points. High energy. Lock this into your memory right now.
Point one, comparison versus settlement. Comparison is matching the trade details. It is the agreement. Settlement is the actual exchange of delivery and payment. Mismatched reports do not establish an agreement, and pushing them through a system doesn't magically fix them.
Point two, DK trades. Silence to a DK notice equals a DK. It means we don't agree the trade happened. Do not confuse this with an aged delivery fail, which is a fully confirmed trade that Sloppy Sam just forgot to settle.
Point three, DVP and RVP. Delivery versus payment protects against credit risk during the settlement exchange. It prevents one-sided bankruptcy. DVP is the delivering or selling side. RVP is the receiving or buying side.
Customer DVP transactions and depository eligible securities must settle by book entry, meaning digital ledgers, no physical paper.
Point four, repos. A repo is a sale and an agreement to repurchase. If a broker-dealer retains custody of the counterparty's collateral, they need four things to protect the customer: a written agreement, a confirmation receipt, a protection notice, and actual segregated possession and control.
Point five, continuous net settlement, or CNS, the giant bar tab. It nets all daily activity and open fails into one net long or net short position per security. The magic word is novation. The clearing agency steps in as the ultimate contraparty to everyone. If a fail remains at the end of the day, it stays open and carries forward to tomorrow's math.
Point six, buy-ins. Standard buy-ins can happen no sooner than the third business day after the due date and require prior written notice. Cash or guaranteed delivery contracts can be bought in the next day without prior notice. Sam can defend himself by demanding proof or showing physical possession.
Point seven, RegSHO closeouts, the SEC mandates. Market maker fails give you until the third consecutive settlement day and you can purchase or borrow. Deemed owned restricted fails give you 35 calendar days, but they require a purchase only.
Beautifully summarized.
Boom, that is exactly what you need to know to survive these questions. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, something to mull over while you're taking your practice tests.
Yeah, think about the continuous net settlement system we just described. We said the clearing corporation, the bartender steps between every single buyer and every single seller through novation. They become the ultimate guarantor, the universal counterparty, to remove risk between individual brokers.
Right.
But if they absorb all of that risk to protect the system, what happens if the clearing corporation itself faces a catastrophic failure? If the ultimate guarantor fails, where does the systemic risk go?
It's the ultimate too big to fail scenario. If the bartender holding the giant tab suddenly goes bankrupt, who owes who? It's a terrifying and fascinating question about the very foundation of global finance. Thank you for diving into the muddy waters with us today. Kids reviewing those timelines, remember Sloppy Sam and Cautious Chloe, and good luck on your Series 99 exam. You are going to crush it.